Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. It's nice to be back among friends. It's good to see you. Les asked me to share about my experiences when I went to Japan in December of last year. I was in a Japanese Zen monastery from December 5th through January 5th. So it was a month in duration. And the temple is unrenowned. It's a very small temple, I think with 20 monks maximum, one roshi, and about 2 to 3 visiting monks. So at one point, Huitsu, which is the son of Shunryu Suzuki, came and assisted with the teaching. It's a training monastery in Okayama, Japan. So I'd like to begin my talk by just remembering one of the people that used to go here, Avona Trigg. So those of you who remember Avona went to Tassajara Mountain Monastery for 6 months. Avona went there for 3 months during the summer period and then 3 months during the winter period. And after he gave his Dharma talk about his experiences, I shared with him that I so want to go to Tassajara, but you know I'm so afraid of the cold. And he just looked at me and simply said, "Don't be." So that's my intention in sharing my experiences with you. If you, ever you intend to train at a monastery, and I'm sure once you make that intention, you'll encounter a lot of fears. And I would like to offer you the same words that if you have that intention and it's your fears that prevent you, then don't be. Because I myself had 3 types of fears before heading there, and I'm happy to say none of them came true. So it's more specifically, the first fear was of shaving my head. Before that, I took ordination here with Les, shaved my head, and experienced a very awkward year of people taking double looks and treating me like I'm a cancer survivor and just wondering what my political persuasions were and just a lot of strange things that happened. And so I was wondering, wow, can I do that again? And how anxious will I be? And will that really prevent me from entering the monastery? I'm happy to say that I delayed my head shaving until the very last day before I took the final train to the monastery and had my head shaved at the barbershop in Haneda International at Tokyo Airport. And it was wonderful. So a wonderful experience. I just showed the barber a picture of my shaved head and said, and even though it's only for men, right, he allowed me in and he put the nice little aprons around me. And to make sure that's what I really wanted, he looked at me and said, "Skin head?" I said, "Hi, please, skin head." It was a wonderful, relaxing, warm, nurturing experience. I highly recommend it if ever you want to get your head shaved. And I was completely relaxed. And I don't know where that change of attitude came from, but it just came. The second thing I was afraid of was physical pain. I experience pain on a monthly basis, and I was afraid that that might keep me from practice, and if I couldn't sit or I couldn't do everything everyone else did, I didn't know what the consequences would be. But there's something, I don't know what it is, that something just happened. And during my time there, the pain that I usually get every month wasn't so bad. And I'm not sure what the difference was, but it just wasn't an issue. The third thing I was afraid of was transitioning back. And I was afraid that coming back with a shaved head would be very, very awkward, like last year. And on that front also, something shifted, something changed, that I compared the pictures of myself now and last year, and it's exactly the same, but somehow I'm not so bothered. And the people around me don't seem to take issue with how I look at all. So if you're ever concerned about whether you'll fit in or if you can live life peaceably because of your practice or how you look, I'd like to just share with you that that's not been my experience. It hasn't been such a big deal. And people tend to treat you more by how you treat them than how you look. So now that we overcome the part about fears, let's get into what is it like there. I think the marker of a monastic life is basically what is not there, what's not included. The walls are very bare. You know, there's nothing hanging except maybe some calligraphy. There is very little by way of personal possessions. You come there with two outfits. One is your monk's robes, which I'm wearing, and the other is called a samway. It's your work clothes. And that's basically your uniform. So you travel very lightly and you live very lightly. There's no access to the outside world. You don't go beyond temple gates. So just by those parameters, there's a lot that you're not exposed to. You don't partake in media. You don't have access to the internet, the radio. You don't see billboards, no magazines. The only book there is a sutra book. And this might be very obvious, but I'll mention it. There's no drugs, no drinking, no alcohol. There's no meat there, so there's no killing involved. There's no acquisition. And I'm just stating the obvious, but when I came back to life here, those things are always in front of you, right? I mean, your whole life, you're consuming, you're buying things, and you're busy buying more things, or you're consuming things via the internet, or you're indulging in behaviors. Maybe you're procreating. And in the monastic life, you just abstain from a lot of things. And just from that sense of not doing, it frees you up to live a moral life, basically. Because if you look at the Buddhist formula, it's very simple. It's basically cease doing evil and spend your time doing good. So when you go to a monastery, you suddenly have these boundaries around your activities in your life, and you cease from harming other beings with your actions. And when you do that, there's a lot of energy that's available for you, for your spiritual practice. So, I think I brought that up because it's one of the things that scares people. You know, that, because you think, well, if I don't have my own bed, I don't have my toys, and if I don't have my, you know, my hobbies, how can I be happy? So I just want to tell you my experience that just not worrying about what I'm going to eat, what I'm going to wear, what I'm going to buy next, it gave me a sense of ease. And there was room for just really focusing on what's in front of me. And this sense of having modest possessions, you have basically your two outfits and not much more, you're basically saying to yourself and those around you that my needs are modest. I'm a low maintenance kind of person. And when that happens, you find out that your needs are taken care of. So when you live there, someone's cooking for you or you're cooking for others. You know, the rent's taken care of. You have a job in front of you. You don't have to go looking for it. And so basically, if you share everything, everything is shared, everything is communal, then there's enough to go around and you don't have to worry so much. So what that creates is a spaciousness and the ability to just feel on a daily basis a sense of contentment, that what's in front of you is enough. And just this thing that you're doing, whether it's cleaning the toilets or raking the leaves or sawing bamboo, that's what's important. That's enough. So I would like to have these little pauses in my talk. I only have three or four points that I'd like to speak to, but I'd like to engage you in some questions because I would like to bridge the experience that was so far away, you know, in this countryside in Japan, to our lives here in Silicon Valley. So I would ask you for a moment to now to wonder or to reflect on the idea of voluntary simplicity. So what are three ways that you can simplify your life? What are three ways that you can reduce harm, either to others or the planet we live on? And I think this is an important question because that's how we bring the practice into our modern life. Yes, Ken.
Some of it, like, see, obviously, get away from the computer. these certain things become obvious that aren't obvious to you now. I couldn't answer three of them. I don't know what they would be. And look at the answer. Maybe that's part of the problem too, right? We're all problem solvers in this valley. That's all we do. We just take in problems and we solve these problems. And I can imagine being in an environment where if it was all taken care of, I wouldn't have any problems. So what would I do? I get really bored. I don't know. I have a lot of questions for you, but that's probably afterwards. So that's all I have to say. What the three would be, but I'd probably disconnect from a lot of our communicating devices that we use and think are just simple enough to have. But that kind of means don't really work and drop out of this place.
Thank you. I think the biggest way we do harm to others is how we look at other people and how we engage with them. And I can see how when you were with 20 people like yourself, how amazing it must have been. And it's so difficult in this place, in this world, to engage with other people and not make judgments and not look at them either as they're better or worse than you. So I feel like that's how we do the most harm, is how we engage with each other. And so amazing that you were able to spend a month being around 20 other like-minded people. And we were probably accepting of one another and just seeing each other as just as beautiful people, which is hard to do. And I think that's how we, at least I find myself constantly checking myself, you know, trying not to make judgments, trying not to be open with people and accepting. So I think that's one big way for me, what I've learned from what you're saying. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you for what you're sharing. That is beautiful. Your question triggered a thought, and the way I look at it, I feel like gratefulness is a my little key, anyway, for me, as it, when I'm very grateful, there's this sense of deep appreciation, this sense of not taking things for granted. And that implies that there's a consciousness of the moment when you don't take things for granted. And this sense of true appreciation. And from true and deep appreciation comes respect. You know, and when you're really respecting something, it's like you don't want to harm it. So I think just cultivating gratefulness can maybe help us here where, you know, we don't have such a safe container and that like you had. Maybe just cultivating gratefulness can help us, and it definitely helps me. Not harm others and, you know, cultivate respect for one another and also everything we encounter in life, animals, and just not taking things for granted, you know, showing true appreciation for them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess it's very familiar to all of us, the sort of mantra about consumerness and like what we're writing on the earth, minimizing the carbon footprint and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly is true that we seem to have this compulsion in our modern society. We have lots of sort of matter and energy flowing through our minds. You know, we require more stuff, we throw a lot of stuff away, and use a lot of energy doing it. But aside from the fact that that has an impact on the planet, I think a lot of people think, well, if I'm going to reduce that impact, I'm going to have to sort of give up something, I'm going to have to sacrifice something. And it seems to me that it's a win-win situation. You can lighten your impact on the planet and at the same time make yourself feel a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the sort of consumer society we have here is this wonderful joking phrase, but I think it's a joke because there's sort of truth behind it. People say when they're feeling anxious and upset that they're going to go practice some retail therapy, go buy something, that'll make me feel better.
Yeah.
Buy something, eat something, throw something away, use some more energy, and somehow numb the existential angst of the modern society. And it seems to me that simplifying the life can not only lighten your footprint on the earth, but it can also make you feel a whole lot better.
Mm. Thank you.
Jobs who had 20 black turtlenecks and that's the only thing he wore. And I thought, oh, well, maybe I could do something similar and just have, I don't know, 10 t-shirts. But I'm going to think about that. Thank you.
That's a good point. So it was half foreigners, so a lot of people from Australia and Europe, like the Netherlands, Switzerland, Romania, and the other half were Japanese. And the majority of the Japanese monks were there to fulfill requirements to get a license. So Toshoji is a training temple, and what that means is that there are different levels of temples in Japan, and many of them are home temples, they are family temples, and they are passed down from father to son. So what that means is the son needs to be there when the father ages and dies to continue the temple. And the son then needs to get an education, go to Komazawa University like Suzuki Roshi did. And then after that, you spend at least a year at a training temple, whether it's Eheiji, Sojiji, and in this case, Toshoji. And you spend at least a year, and depending on your progress, I overheard that one monk had to spend 3 years because his father was unhappy with his progress. So it depends on what you're there for. There are certificates that you receive when you do shuso ceremony and so forth that will help you qualify for your license. And then I met people who were there, let's say the monks I met from Australia, one was an anthropologist, for half a year, and then he comes and practices for 3 to 9 months out of the year. A very serious student. And another person I met has a 10-year visa. So he's a devotee of the teacher. So there are different ranges. And you can come for a couple of weeks, or you can come for years, depending on your relationship with the teacher. And but I'd like to say a little more, Dave, about your point of acquisition, and how that was one of the things that really stood out for me when I came back here to live my life. I discovered that there was this very subtle yet pervasive message that if one thing is good, then more is better. So there are so many ways in which you can access goods, and it can happen 24/7. And what I discovered that is that you spend so much of your life in acquiring things. Let me give you a very mundane example. I wanted to buy some dog food, and I spent 20 minutes reading reviews. You know, my time, my life energy is spent doing this act of very serious acquisition. You know, it's so subtle, and it can really leech out the time in your day. So it's very subtle, so I'm very happy you brought that up. And also when your time is busy, spent planning and acquiring, and then, you know, working more to maintain what you have, then there's very little space to just kind of have that gap, you know, that moment when you say, wow, this feels really nice, exactly where I am. You know, just this is enough. So that's the trade-in when we spend our time acquiring. So what do the monks do when they're not doing all this stuff? So let me tell you the schedule. You wake up at 3:45 and you're in the zendo by 4:20. And if you're, and that means, and when you're a monk, every moment of your time is accounted for. So when you wake up, there's a gata, there's a saying that you run through. Then when you put on your clothes, there's a saying that you rehearse. And then when you brush your teeth, there's a saying that you rehearse. When you wash your face, there's a saying that you rehearse. When you go to a toilet, there's a saying that you rehearse. So basically every moment is accounted for. And I'll tell you one of my favorites. It's translated into English. I don't know the Japanese version because they gave me this sutra book with translations. But it's while I'm brushing my teeth, I care for the eye teeth that bites through all afflictions. Brushing my teeth, I care for the eye teeth that bites through all afflictions. I don't know what an eye teeth is, but I really like the idea. So there's this wish that you're constantly generating, that each action that I take may it be for the good of all beings. Boiled down, basically that's what all of them say. You know, when I wash my face, may I purify my thoughts. You know, so every action is, a donation towards the collective good. That's why you do it. So you put on your clothes, and there's a certain way that you tie your belts, and there's a certain way that you put on your boots. boots, and there's a certain way that you turn your zafu. There's a certain foot that you use to step in the doorway. There's a certain foot that you step out of the doorway. And there's a certain place in line that you get into. So every moment is an opportunity to pay attention to where you are and what you're doing. And the Japanese word for that is gyo, meaning ritual. And another translation is etiquette. So a big moment in the day is mealtime, and we do orioki for breakfast and lunch, and an informal orioki at dinner. So every mealtime is very elaborate, because you're at a table. It's not the way we do here, where it's almost a single person orioki, then you watch everyone else. At the monastery, it was combined with passing food, and there's a certain way and order in which you pass food, and at the end of each meal, you get a pickle, and you take the pickle to wipe down your bowl so that you get all of the pieces, and you eat the pickle, and then you get a tea, and you pour the tea in, and you drink everything. So there's not a scrap wasted. And then there's a way that you do it so that it's pretty much from start to finish, it's done in 15 minutes. So it's a very efficient, elegant way to make sure, one, that everyone's fed, two, that it's equally portioned, and three, that there's no mess, and there's very little left to do for the people in the cleanup crew. So what I noticed about, this is my experience with all that ritual. One is that you'll never get it right. Especially being a newbie, maybe I gave up after the third day of really getting it right. And trust me, there's someone who'll notice when you don't do it right. Because they've all been there, you know, they've been through your shoes as the newbie, and every task that you learn, someone else has been there before you. So someone will give you a tip or an advice or a reminder. And after 20 times a day wherein you realize that you didn't do it right, you start relaxing. And give up any notion that your ego depends on any sense of competency. So if you're a high performer in the Silicon Valley, this might be a really nice antidote for you. That who you are is okay, even if you don't have a high level of competency. And the learning curve is really high. Get used to making mistakes and be humble about it. So obviously, that's a great way to cultivate humility. And the second thing is, it's not comfortable, right? It's not comfortable to kind of always miss something. And things are designed so that you're slightly off balance. An example is, every day you're just working really hard and you're concentrating. And then by the fifth day, it's called Hosan. So Hosan day, there's one period of sitting instead of two in the morning, and there might or might not be a sitting in the evening, and you have a little more time to take care of yourself. That means you can do your laundry, you know, you can wipe your orioki bowls from all those mistakes you've made, and you can just take care of things. So, but here's the kicker. So when you go to the bathhouse, you usually wear your samurai and your rakusu because it's a formal event. You go there, you do prostrations, you offer incense before you take off your clothes and bathe. So on Hosan day, you go there in your full attire and all of your robes and your okesa, just to remind you that don't relax too much yet. And so, it's these little details that just keep you on your toes. So another impact that this practice had for me was this notion of wanting to be comfortable. And it's something that I really noticed creeping up on me when I returned here, that this desire for things to go my way, a desire for things to be comfortable and convenient. At some point I let go of that when I was at Toshoji, that no one cares what I think. No one cares about my timing. No one cares if I don't like to rush when I eat. But you just roll with it. But somehow that sort of opening that I experienced somehow got a little more, I lost a sense of it to the point where I'm thrown off guard now when things don't go my way. You know, like when you're driving and someone cuts you off, like you forget that, oh, that just goes with the territory, that just happens, right? But I find myself cussing and not being happy and saying this person should be more aware and so forth. So a consequence of not being so open to discomfort or being willing to experience discomfort, I think, is a sense of unhappiness. You know, when someone says something or that you don't like, it can stew for a while now. And I think it, because beneath that is this underlying expectation or assumption that things should be more comfortable than they are. So let me speak to this last thing, and I think it's the most important thing about living in a ritual space. Because from the time you wake up to the time you sleep at the monastery, you're in ritual. There's always some sort of ritual happening. And what that requires is a lot of attention and coordination from a lot of people. Like for instance, tonight, you know, Lee did the bells and Ken did the han and Les performed his opening ceremony, and we all had to pay attention and work together for that to be beautiful and seamless. So that level of listening to each other and coordination and harmonization happened all day. It happened all day. And so it just creates this bond between people, and it creates a desire to listen to each other. And it gave me a new definition of beauty. So prior to going there and practicing, my perception of beauty was mostly physical or external, you know, like the balance of the flowers is an external thing, it's a physical thing. But when I witnessed these rituals day in, day out, and I saw what it took to make something happen, you know, just so many people working so hard. You know, for example, Zazen at 4:20 in the morning, someone woke up and was there at 3:30 to start the fire. You know, it was during December, it was about 0 degrees some mornings. So it was very cold. And so someone woke up half an hour early to tend to the fire to make sure the zendo was warm so we could all sit. So everyone worked really hard together. So for me, beauty is the ability to coordinate with each other, the ability to harmonize your actions with others. And beauty is also a sense of self-possession. No matter how cold it is, no matter how tired you are, you get up and you do what you need to do so others may experience the Zazen period. That requires a level of generosity and self-possession. So maybe that's why my hair doesn't bother me so much anymore. So my question question for you is, when are the moments in your life where you witness a beautiful act? When is there harmony between people? And how do you cultivate that sense of ease and gracefulness in yourself? How do we do that here?
In a sense, it's almost constantly all over, like, you know, the grocery store, you have the cashier, somebody's bringing the food in, somebody's, you know, the butcher in the back, and, you know, like, you would think that where I work is a beautiful place. There's, like, I work with about 200 people. The people deliver stuff to me that I work with, we deliver it to someone else, and it just seems like, you know, the way everybody's working, supporting each other in different ways.
Thank you.
I think we have to struggle more. I think I thought about when you were talking about beauty, about that sign of the archery rangers that you were talking about in your last visit to Japan. Things not being comfortable. I think it's in the type of environment you're describing, you can find meaning and truth in that discomfort, because it's true that we struggle.
I find when we have Shishin here, and I get to stand by the door over there and open it and allow servers to come in here and they traverse their paths, it's almost like a ballet. Mm-hmm. And I can watch them doing it, I can watch them serve, and watch people receive the food. And it's just, it's this process that goes on, but in truth, I can look at it and it's quite a beautiful thing. Which leads me into ritual in itself. It really connects me with who I am, with who all came before me, and who's, in some ways, who's going to come after me too, if they follow that same ritual. But I find Horyuki eating in the mealtime, I have the best job in the place when I can stand by that door and watch all that stuff go on. It's really, really magnificent. So that's my
I think one place I've seen wordless awareness of one another play out really beautifully is actually at the gym in the weightlifting area, because everyone knows that you shouldn't interrupt someone who's lifting something really heavy. And you also know that if you stay in one place for too long, you're going to be in someone's way. And so there's this wordless dance of people coming to pick up weights and move to somewhere else and do their exercise and put them back. And somehow, no one else seems to be in anyone else's way. And I think it's really beautiful that they all manage to do it without talking to each other. A, because they have their headphones in and they don't want to make eye contact. But also, they just know that, like, you're here for your own time, and perhaps the best consideration they can give you is the consideration of knowing that you need to get to the weights that are in front of them.
Thank you. And what I'm gathering from all your responses is that if you have the eyes to see it, there's harmony all around you, isn't there? Do we have time for one more point? Do we have time for one more point? We do? Okay. Okay. So one of the things that was a core value at the monastery was the sense of community. You eat together, you sleep together, you work together, you chant together, you sit zazen together, you do everything together. So there actually is more time spent in the Buddha hall than in the Zendo. So the Zendo is sort of like where you begin, you open the day, and where you close the day. But then after you sit, everyone moves in a formation to the Buddha hall. And the Buddha hall is where, so in the Zendo at this monastery was Manjushri, where you cultivate wisdom. And when you go to the Buddha hall, there sits Avalokiteshvara, where you cultivate compassion. So there's a lot of chanting that happens together. And the chants go anywhere from very fast, very quickly, to very slow and melodic, depending on the ritual for that day. And it can be simple and simplified, or it can be very, very elaborate with a lot of bells and whistles and drums and big taiko drums going on and a lot of coordinated movements. But what I discovered was that the more I threw myself into the rituals, the more I allowed my voice to project and harmonize with others, the stronger I felt, not only internally, but the more connected and woven in I felt with the community. So there's something that happens when you join your voices together over a long period of time. And these could be very long rituals over an hour where you just go from one thing to another. There's something very powerful about joining our voices. And like Ken said, there's a way that you weave yourself into the past when you chant the names of the ancestors, or when you chant something like the Heart Sutra, which has been chanted for thousands of years. And there's a way that you care for the future by just continuing these practices and making sure they're alive. And there's a place for every person. So in Japan, everything is very hierarchical. So there's, you know, starting from the senior down to the novice, and the beauty of that is that there's always a place. You have a place within that, no matter where you are. And I was the last one for a long time, and what I discovered was that last doesn't equal worse. It just means you wait a little longer, and that's okay. But when you're not there, someone notices, or when you're not stepping in line at a certain time, someone notices. And in that way, it's reassuring, because there's always someone who has you, you know, who has your back. And that's, for me, that was really a pleasant experience, to be accounted for and included and noticed and welcomed. So my question for you is, what activities do you engage in that reminds you that you're part of a greater whole? And part of that is, when do you show appreciation to those around you? Because I think when we pay attention to others, there's a likelihood that we appreciate them too. And while you're thinking, I'd like to share one moment that really touched me. Was that usually someone who does Kokyo, the person who leads the chants, they tend to be a more experienced monk. You know, some of these monks have been doing it since they were a wee little thing in their temple, and so they're very used to chanting these verses. And they're archaic Japanese, it's not a modern day language that people practice. So it's something you have to be exposed to. And then the way that you carry the tone and the tune as well. So one time, there was a monk who wasn't so practiced, and he had to do Kokyo. And there was an immediate stop in the ritual. And everyone notices, right, when there's that gap, when things aren't flowing. And I just saw someone ever so quietly move across the Buddha hall. And I could hear him whispering in his ear about the next line, and the next line, and the next line, until it was finished. So that's what happens. You know, it's not ever about performance, even though it can look like it. It's about just each of us learning something new and supporting each other in that.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because I have this image of temples in Japan being very strict and no tolerance of mistakes. Like people, whoever makes a mistake is really punished. Mm-hmm. It seems that the place where you went is not like that.
Yeah, it's a training ground. So the expectation actually is that you will make a lot of mistakes. And I think if they devoted their energy to hitting people, they'll spend all day doing it. So might as well just be kind and let things flow along.
See that in monastic life too. I mean, mm-hmm. When you're in the monastic world, you have to feel like you don't make mistakes, you have to win the opinion of the higher ups and that type of thing,
mm-hmm.
And you're never going to succeed doing that either, right?
Right.
And that's a key part.
Mm-hmm.
But it would seem to me that one of the real keys to lasting happiness is to be comfortable living your life as not necessarily an eccentric but someone who's very comfortable being themselves in the face mm-hmm. of other people who you're never going to change their opinion or win their opinion anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I have kind of a story about that. There's a guy in Palo Alto who owns a lot of properties, and he rents these properties to Stanford kids. Anybody went to Stanford would know this guy. But he's pretty eccentric. He has no material possessions. I don't think he owns a car. He really lives this kind of hippie, anti-establishment lifestyle. But ironically, he has a tremendous amount of net worth and financial means because he doesn't live on anything. He lives in one of the garages of one of his houses. But I think that what he's accomplished this freedom from the good opinion of other people. And he can truly see his own life and live his own life because he's not tied to it.
Yeah. Thank you. So I would just like to comment on that comment, and we'll end there. So basically, my motivation in going to Japan was that I took ordination in November of last year or something, the year before, and suddenly I was wearing robes and I just felt very awkward. You know, I felt awkward in them. I didn't know how to handle them. I didn't know how to handle this thing called the izagu. And I didn't really know what taking that step meant. So I wanted to see for myself from the roots of the practice to understand what really did I sign up for. So here's the thing. If you don't spend your life, you know, trying to get your needs met, it's taken care of. You know, if you don't spend your life trying to further your career or to get the next item, or to somehow make yourself more comfortable, what do you do? You know, and that's mainly the opportunity you get to discover when you're at a monastery. Because suddenly your energy is freed up from all the things that you would normally have to take care of. And how do you spend your time then? And I asked myself that question, like, why did I travel all the way here? And I'm standing here in Japan, what am I doing? And the answer became so clear, so apparent, that, and I don't know where it came from, but this voice just said, you're here to love them. You're just here to express that. And I found that really freeing. And it opened up a lot of energy to be present for people. And when I took care of things, I just did it 110%. Not because I wanted someone to approve of me, but it's because this is my chance to take care of this room. This is my chance to scrub the tiles, just because I'm here. This is where I am right now. And I'll pour myself into it. And then I was spent every evening. You know, there's no energy left for anything else. And thank goodness, it feels good to be completely used up in that way. So I would just like to end with saying that I went to Japan to feel more comfortable in my robes. And what I left with is that the sense of being very comfortable in my own skin. Thank you for that comment.
Fong, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canandoe.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.